He's a psychologist, an author, and a veteran broadcaster. But most importantly, he's a dad. Welcome to Dr. Bill Meyer Live on the Faith Radio Network. Stay tuned for a faith and culture connection, a biblical perspective on current events, and practical family advice with psychologist Dr. Bill Meyer. You can join the conversation by calling 877-93-FAITH. That's 877-933-2484. Now, let's join Bill Meyer live.
Welcome and Merry Christmas. Can you believe it? We're less than a week away. And I hope you've got your Christmas shopping done, because the malls are going to be completely insane this weekend. You would not catch me dead anywhere near a mall. Well, there is one gift I have to buy for my wife that I think I can avoid the mall. I think I can go to a different area of town far away from the malls and manage to pick up that gift for her before Christmas. But I do wish you a Merry Christmas and hope you're planning on a wonderful time with family and friends over the next week or two. And what is one of the best Christmas gifts you can give your kids this year? It's not an iPod. It's not an iPhone. It's not a rainbow loom set for your 7-year-old daughter. It is actually making faith more relevant in your home. And, you know, I was looking at this week. There's so many studies out showing that we got a large number of Christian young people who are abandoning their faith in college. And we've also got research showing that many of these kids are not coming back to the church or to Christianity. I had a chance to speak to an adult Sunday school class on this topic last week. These were parents of middle school students and high school students, and just kind of asking the question of how do we keep our kids Christian in college? And I told them, I said, you know, if our Christianity is limited to an hour or two on Sunday mornings, our kids are going to come to view our faith as hypocritical and meaningless. And there's some great research that was done at the University of North Carolina, and it shows that if our teenagers and our preteens, if they are actively involved in a faith community, they are much less likely to fall victim to some of the risky behaviors that so many kids are getting involved in these days. You know, I've talked about this a lot, whether we're talking about drugs or alcohol or sexuality or some of the very bad stuff that can go on with mobile technology these days, including things like sexting. There's just a lot of risks out there. And if our kids are plugged into a vital youth group where they are getting fed on a weekly basis, and if they have moms and dads who are feeding them spiritually on a weekly basis, they're much less likely to get involved in some of this junk. And, of course, prayer is so critical in making faith relevant in your home. And I would encourage you, just as you look toward the beginning of a new year, if you're not praying in your family on a regular basis, make it a priority. Pray with your kids. Pray for your kids. And as you pray for your kids, ask God to help you provide them with the kind of unfailing love and clear moral guidance that they're going to need to survive in a world that is full of those dangers and temptations. And, you know, an excellent place to go for resources that will help you be more intentional about passing on faith to your kids is Focus on the Family. And, you know, I've got to admit, I'm a little bit partial to that ministry since I worked for them for about 9 years. And you can call Focus. In fact, even on Saturdays, they do take calls. 1-800-A-FAMILY is their number. 1-800, the letter A and the word family. Or you can find them on the web at Focus on the Family. Just Focus on the FocusandFamily.com, and just look in the search engine for faith lessons or making faith relevant to your kids, and you'll find just a ton of great material there. Well, I got an email from Scott, and Scott lives in Madison, Wisconsin, and Scott says, "Dear Dr. Bill, I am having a tough time feeling joyous this Christmas. It's been a difficult year. My mother passed away, my daughter became very ill, and I was laid off from work. So it's hard to feel joyful or thankful this Christmas. It seems phony to try and act that way when I don't feel like it. So what should I do? when everybody around me feels happy? Do I just grit my teeth and pretend, or can I be honest about how I feel? And Scott, man, my heart goes out to you. You are obviously, you've gone through a lot this past year, a tremendous amount of hardship, and I know that losing a parent can be particularly painful. You may have heard me mention on this program, I lost my own mom to a brain cancer a few years ago. And when life seems full of hardship, Scott, I believe there are two things we need to remember. The first is that hard truth that we live in a fallen world. And among other things, the fall has, of course, affected our physical bodies, and that causes things like sickness and death. But we also need to remember, and this time of year in particular, that Jesus Christ came to reconcile us to God, and to reconcile us to each other, and to reconcile us to our own true nature, the way we were intended to be by God, the way we were created. And you know, he promises us that he will never leave us or forsake us. No matter how much pain or suffering we experience in this life, we can count on spending eternity with him. And Scott, the Bible promises us, it says, he will wipe away the tear from every eye, and there will be no more sickness and no more pain and no more death. And yet God wants us to be honest with him about how we're feeling. And that's, it sounds like, Scott, as you look around your, you know, sphere of influence, your life, your friends, your work colleagues, and everybody's, you know, all joyous about Christmas, and you're just not feeling it. That's okay. Be honest about your sorrow, because the Bible gives us that great example. David poured out his heart to God in the Psalms over and over again. Job cried out to him in the midst of incredible grief and suffering. So tell the Lord how sad you are and how frustrated you are and how hopeless you're feeling right now. He hears you. He hears you, Scott, even though there may be times when it doesn't feel like it. And, man, I'm going to be praying for you, brother. You've got a week left, less than a week left till Christmas, and you're feeling these things. And this, I know it's not going to be the happy elf on a shelf Christmas that maybe you hoped for. But I will be praying for you. And all of us here at Faith Radio, we regularly pray for our listeners. And we want you to know that God is with you every moment of every day. So thank you, Scott, for your email. Well, it's 11 minutes past the hour. I'm Bill Meyer, and coming up next, we're going to be talking to a pastor who has a very interesting perspective on masculinity in the church. Do we have it all wrong? Are guys being given a message, one message from the culture and another message from the church, and are either one of them accurate, actually? Nate Pyle joins us up next here on the Faith Radio Network.
Continues right now, and we want to hear from you. Call us at 877-933-2484. That's 877-933-2484. Now, here's Dr. Bill Meyer again on Faith Radio.
And we'd love to hear from you today. In fact, you may have a question for our guest, and you can feel free to call in the next 45 minutes or so. Our guest is Nate Pyle. He is the lead pastor at Christ Community Church in Fishers, Indiana, which is a suburb of Indianapolis. Nate is also involved in a joint effort of revitalizing churches and missional engagement in the Reformed Church of America and the Christian Reformed Church. His writings have been featured in places as various as the Huffington Post, Sojourners, and more. He's a regular blogger on faith issues, and you can find his blog at natepyle.com. And Nate, welcome to Faith Radio.
Thanks. It's great to be with you.
Well, first of all, I should say Merry Christmas to you and your family. I've actually been to Fishers, Indiana before. You live in a beautiful spot. And thank you for taking a little time out here just a week before Christmas.
Wow, thank you. Merry Christmas to you and to all the listeners as well. It's great to be with you all.
Now, in recent years, Nate, there has been this shift in American Christianity. And there have been a lot of leaders telling guys things like man up and be the warrior that God made you to be. And I'm wondering, how do we reach that point? And do you consider that message to be a good thing or a bad thing?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think we're coming to that place where pastors are exhorting men to, you know, as you say, man up, be the big man, however they word it. Because I do think that there's a lot of questions out in culture surrounding gender. I mean, there's a lot of shifts that are happening in the conversation around gender and, you know, and feminism. And there's some really good things that come with that. And there's also some questions about what that means for how men and women relate to one another, to, you know, all kinds of other issues that are just new questions and new frontiers when it comes to talking about gender. And I think that that's created this anxiety surrounding what does it mean to be a man? And for that matter, even what does it mean to be about a woman? But for me, you know, writing a men's book, I really wanted to take on this question. What does it mean to be a man? And so I think that, you know, the exhortations that are coming from pastors and from other Christian leaders are stemmed from that anxiety that we feel out there about just these questions about what does it now look like to be a man in a changing culture in society with different expectations, all of that sort of stuff. Now, whether or not those exhortations are helpful, I'm not so sure. I don't think that they are, which is a big reason as to why I wrote the book Man Enough. I think that they can be shame inducing, and I think they can put undue pressure on men to be something that they're not.
Now, the title of the book is Man Enough, How Jesus Redefines Manhood. So Nate really takes a hard look at what Jesus tells us about things like masculinity and how we are to live our Christian lives. Let's go back a bit. I know in recent years there has been this argument, whether or not it's accurate, I don't know, that the church at some point became feminized. And pretty much a lot of the, other than, you know, you're typically your senior pastor, a lot of the work in the church has been done by women. You know, women tend to lead the committees and make the potlucks and teach the Sunday school classes. And guys, in many cases, just sort of go along reluctantly with their wives and their kids to church, but maybe aren't particularly involved. They put all their energy or a large part of their energy into their work. And church is just sort of a place they go on Sunday because their wife drags them there. I don't know if that's necessarily accurate. It probably varies greatly on, you know, what denomination you're involved in, what faith tradition you come from. But if you, as you looked at this, do you believe there was a point in the American church where perhaps some denominations started to really become more feminized? And how did that affect the guys in those congregations?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. And I'm not, you know, in researching the book, that conversation came up a lot. You know, is the American church being feminized or has it become too feminized? And is that why there are less men involved in the church because the church doesn't speak their language, so to speak? But what I found in doing the research is that that claim that the church has been feminized or is being feminized goes back, you know, 100, you can find claims of that 150 years ago, that the church has been feminized or that the pastors or the men who are highly involved in church are more effeminate. And so I'm always a little bit suspicious, particularly when it seems like people are talking about the more recent church, you know, in the last 20, 30 years, when they say that the church is being feminized. I get a little suspicious there because that argument has been there for so long. I do think, you know, when even if you go all the way back to the early church, we see a high level of involvement of women within the early church taking different positions of leadership or even, you know, different areas of service. So, you know, if you think back to Jesus and the disciples, their ministry was largely supported by women who took care of them or provided for them financially and all of that sort of stuff. So women have always had a really high role within the church. And I don't think that's changed. What I think is happening or why it's perceived that the church has been feminized or is feminized is that when we look at where guys like to hang out in American culture, that, you know, it's around sports. It's, you know, going to sports arenas. It's going to gun clubs. It's doing, you know, these different types of events that are very masculine in feeling. And the church feels less less masculine compared to that. And it always will, I think, at least, because 50% of the people who are involved in church are women, if not more than 50%. And so when you compare church to what happens on a Sunday morning at, you know, in my context, at the Lucas Oil Stadium with the Indianapolis Colts, church is going to look less masculine. When you even look at some of the other, you know, the men's clubs that are out there, the church looks less masculine. And I think it's those types of comparisons that cause people to say, well, the church is more feminine. And I'm not sure that that's necessarily a bad thing, because there is a large portion of those who attend church that are women.
Now, one of the reasons you wrote this book, it came out of your own personal journey. So let's just spend a few minutes talking about what kind of messages you heard growing up about what it means to be a man and a Christian, and then how you've kind of maybe worked through that as an adult and as a pastor.
Yeah, that's great. For me, I've grown up in the church. I've never not known Jesus. So I've always had some sort of interaction with Christ and with church and with the gospel. And in growing up in the Christian context, for me, what I heard was that being a man meant that I had to be the leader, that I had to kind of be the place where the buck stopped, that I had to have all the answers to some degree. That I was strong, that I could be a rock for others in their time of need, and that, you know, I would be courageous. And so the image was often used was like that of a warrior, that a man was a warrior, one who would defend, one who would protect, one who would charge into whatever situation needed to be charged into and would take control of that. And so that's the image that I grew up with. And he heard things like, you know, don't be weak, or at least it was implied, don't be weak, don't cry, don't show emotion, all of that sort of stuff. And for me personally, that just wore on me, because that wasn't who I am. It isn't who I am. I'm an emotional guy. I'm sometimes very insecure about things and need to be reassured. And I'm learning that I don't have all the answers. And so I found myself feeling like I had to pretend to be somebody that I'm not in order to be the man that people were telling me I needed to be.
Wow. Now, did this message come from your own dad, from your own father?
Yeah, I don't think that it was ever explicitly stated coming from my dad. I mean, my dad was very involved in our lives, but my dad is also very stoic. We didn't share – there wasn't a whole lot of emotion going on in our family. We're Dutch, and so we like to joke about the fact that there's the Dutchness of being men. Like, we're stoic, we're quiet, we're very reserved. We hold our emotions back. And so there is some of that where I definitely learned that by watching my dad and my uncles and my grandfather. But it was also something that I just observed in culture around me. So in the portrayals of men in movies, the leading men were the guys who knew the answers and who were courageous and would charge into battle. Pastors that I talked to pastors that I had growing up gave this air of they had all the answers. They were the strong leaders. They walked with their head high all the time. And that men, and this was particularly within the church circle, men had to be defenders of the truth and always ready to be able to defend against anybody, whether that was, you know, somebody who was antagonistic towards the faith or someone who just had bad doctrine. You had to be ready to defend the faith at all costs. In all places. And again, some of these things aren't bad, and I don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. But sometimes we take them to such an extreme that they become a really heavy mantle for men to carry.
So then, how does this message that you've heard and that you believe is erroneous, how does that contrast with the message that Jesus gives about masculinity and manhood?
Yeah, it's really interesting. If you look at Jesus and really try to understand how he embodied his humanity within the Roman culture, and you contrast that with the Roman ideals of what it meant to be a man, you see all these ways in which Jesus failed to live up to those expectations. And it's really interesting is that those Roman ideals look a lot like our American ideals. And so things like Jesus showed emotion, and what the Romans would say, they would say his passion even got the better of him. So we see this in the example of Jesus overthrowing the tables in the temple. as Christians, we love that image, and we say, you know, that sometimes we have to do that, and that's what it means to defend truth and to defend, you know, kind of be a warrior for God's honor, that sort of thing. But what the Romans looked at, they said, like, Jesus showed anger there, and he allowed his passions to get the best of him to the point that he acted in a way that brought attention to himself in a negative way in public. They would have also said that Jesus was humiliated when he was when he was, you know, not only when he was crucified, but in all the acts leading up to the crucifixion, by being whipped, by being pierced. He was pierced by the spear, you know. So all of these ways in which he was humiliated in public would have been in an emasculating experience for a man in the Roman culture. He was someone who would have been deemed weak. Again, he cried in public, whereas John records that Jesus wept. He cried in public. So there's a number of ways in which Jesus failed to live into the masculine ideals of the Roman culture. And I think what we're seeing then is Jesus just highlighting for us, whether we be men or women, what it means to be fully human, that we believe Jesus, the divine, that was also fully human, and he lived that fully human life. And what he was doing was not trying to make men more masculine or even women more feminine, but he was trying to show us what it meant to be a perfect human being in relationship with God who embraced the full human experience. And so we see these ways in which he didn't live up to cultural ideals, but he lived up to the intended design of God in creation for humanity.
You know, it's interesting, Nate. When I was in graduate school, we had a professor who gave us an assignment to read the Gospel of Mark and then to highlight every time that Jesus showed emotion. And that gospel in particular, Mark really pays attention to that. And as you said, whether it's anger, whether it's joy, whether it's tears, you know, certainly frustration and righteous indignation toward the Pharisees, sorrow. I mean, you see all these emotions expressed. And this professor said to us, now, look, you know, you often we hear from our culture that there are certain emotions that are negative or bad that we shouldn't express. And that could, you know, could apply to men or women. And he said, but wait a minute, if our Lord and Savior, if Jesus was fully God and fully man, and he is our perfect example, and he displays all those emotions, then who are we to say that certain emotions are wrong or bad, because that flies in the face of the example that God set for us, right?
Exactly. And there's been some research being done. There's a book, I forget who it's by, but it's called Raising Cain. And it's all about the, you know, raising young boys and the life of young boys. And what it talked about in there is how in American culture in particular, our young boys aren't taught how to express their emotions in a healthy manner. And what gets taught and communicated to them through a number of different ways, whether it's through TV shows or movies or other cultural mediums, that the only really safe emotion for a man to express and still be seen as a man is anger.
Hey, Nate, that music's telling me we have to take a quick break, and we'll be right back here on the Faith Radio Network.
I'm Neil Stavem.
And I'm Dick Whitworth, General Manager of Faith Radio. We are all...
It's Dr. Bill Meyer live on Faith Radio. Get ready to join the conversation. Now let's join Dr. Bill Meyer live.
Welcome back and Merry Christmas. Hope you and your family are having a wonderful holiday season. And man, oh man, we're just counting down the days. We have this tradition in our family on Christmas Eve. We open one gift. The kids actually open one gift and they always know what it is. It's always pajamas. It's Christmas pajamas. I think we've been doing this since they were just little itty bitty ones. And so they know come Christmas Eve when that package comes to them, it's going to be some kind of pajamas with, you know, snowman or Santa Claus or Elf on the Shelf or whatever. The really good gifts come the next morning and the stocking and all that, but they get the pajamas on Christmas Eve. So anyway, I don't get pajamas on Christmas. I've never been given pajamas, actually, which is a little bit depressing. Hey, my guest today is Nate Pyle. He is the author of Man Enough, How Jesus Redefines Manhood. Dana, am I man enough if I wear pajamas with Elf on the Shelf logo on them? I mean, is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Before the break, and I apologize, we were kind of cut off there, but we ran out of time for our network break. You started to talk about this book, Raising Cain, and give us a little context and then tell us what you think of it.
Yeah, so I used that book a little bit in some of the research as I was looking at emotions. And Raising Cain talks in there about the environment in which our boys are being raised, particularly in American culture, and some of the struggles that they're facing, and just some of the nuances of raising kids and what they're growing up facing and how it's affecting them. So anyways, in the book, they talk about how for men in American culture and what we teach our young boys through different, you know, media is that it's really unsafe to show emotion. And there's only two types of emotions that are really safe for boys to display. And that would be anger and jealousy. And they're even kind of, you know, they're related. And so it's not safe for a boy in our culture to express sadness. So they learn to express anger. It's not safe for a boy to express vulnerability. And so they express anger. You know, as you just go through the emotional, you know, sort of, the emotional toolbox, if you will, that the majority of emotions are not safe for a boy, and for that matter, for a man to express. And so they express anger. And that's maybe why so many of our young men are angry, is because they haven't learned how to express the whole range of human emotion. And so what I really am trying to do in this book is just start a conversation about what would it look like, particularly for us in the church, who follow, as you were saying before the break, Christ, who expressed all these human emotions. What would it look like for us in the church to encourage our men and disciple our men and teach them what it means to be a full emotional human being, and for it to be safe to express the whole range of human emotions? I think the church could do a lot of good there in helping our young men navigate society.
And yet, let's face it, that's going to be a tough road to hoe, because so many of our guys grew up in homes, and like you were saying, you grew up in a very stoic Dutch Reformed home where, you know, emotions were not expressed and things were not talked about. If we've grown up in that sort of environment, and if that was the model set for us, it's going to be a tough thing to move to that level that we're talking about of being vulnerable and being a person that can express feelings, especially in some type of a public context. So how do guys start to do that in a safe way? Is it through a men's group where maybe that's encouraged and modeled by the leaders? I've found as a psychologist that in group therapy situations, when there is at least one individual that is willing to be transparent and vulnerable, all of a sudden, what starts to happen is that other people feel the freedom to do the same. And so I'm guessing, and I don't know if this is your perspective or not, I'm guessing that you would say that if that starts to occur in a safe place, I would probably say initially for a guy, maybe that needs to be in an all-male group. Eventually, I think it should be in a couples group. But maybe that's the place where a leader or, you know, a guy who has influence starts to be vulnerable, to be transparent, and then the other guys, their walls start to come down. Have you seen that happen in your own church or in other churches?
Yeah, and that I actually agree with you completely on that, that it has to start in small, safe groups. And when I say small, I'm thinking like 2 to maybe 5 at the max. And it is, vulnerability has a way of breeding courage in others that brings about more vulnerability. You know, it gives permission. When somebody is vulnerable, it gives permission to somebody, to the next person, to be vulnerable as well. And so it does have to, I think there has to be a lot of trust within a small group of guys. And there has to be someone who's willing to take that first step, to say what's absolutely so for them and then go one step further. And that gives permission for everybody else in the group to say what they need to say and go a step or two further than what they're truly comfortable with. And so I've seen that personally. The whole book actually comes out of my personal experience of walking into this. And for me, it began with being very vulnerable with one other guy in sort of a moment of crisis when I saw myself and saw my situation more clearly than I had in the past. I expressed that in sort of, at the time, what I would have deemed a moment of weakness, but what I'm now coming to see was a moment of courage, maybe desperate courage even. And I expressed what was going on, what I was seeing about myself, what I was fearing, what I actually believed about who I was and how God saw me. And that was the first step for me to really being honest about who I am and learning to express myself in a more complete way. And from there, it's taken time. That was 4 years ago, and it's taken time for me to now be able to share in other places where maybe in the past I wouldn't have before. So I do think it starts in small groups. I think guides can do that in churches. We have that in our churches where we pair up we like to do triads of guys who do that. And then with Man Enough, there's a study guide. It's a free study guide that I have that people can just email me. They can get the email off my website, off my blog there. They can email me. I will send them the PDF, and it is set up to be done in a smaller group of guys.
Great. Once again, the book is called Man Enough, How Jesus Redefines Manhood, and Nate's website is NatePyle, P-Y-L-E, NatePyle.com. You can find that there, and thank you for making that offer. Now, one thing that's important to note is, obviously, when you shared with this other dude, you felt comfortable enough or safe enough to do that. What was it that told you that I know that I can say this to this guy? Or maybe you didn't know, but I'm assuming you felt like you could spill your guts and that he wouldn't reject you or laugh at you or say, grow up or whatever.
Right.
What was it about this particular friend of yours that let you know, that told you he was safe enough to share this?
Yeah, there's a couple of things. One, at that point, I had known him for 2 years. It was a part of a denominational retreat that we were at this denominational retreat. But I had known him for 2 years in a very sort of in a coaching relationship type thing, but saw him as a mentor. But more than that, so we had the relationship that was established. But more than that, I had seen him model it. So you talked about that earlier. He had modeled what it looked like to be vulnerable in front of a group of about 30 or 40 people on a number of different occasions. And so I knew that he could do that. And it was something that when I saw him do it, it kind of made me step back and go, there's no way in the world I could do that. And at the same time, I admired him for the way he courageously just let us see all of his stuff. And so I had, having seen all that and having a relationship, I knew it was pretty safe to go to him and to say, this is what's going on with me, and I'm kind of at rope's end, and I need someone just to listen and then give me some direction, which he did. So that's how I knew it was safe. I had seen him do it, and I had a relationship with him.
So going back to that moment of crisis, how did he respond when you spilled your guts and shared the struggles you were going through?
Yeah, for one, he listened really well. He continued to ask questions. Rather than trying, he never gave me answers. You know, he never tried to make me feel better. Oh, you're a good guy. Oh, you got it all together. He never gave me any of that. He just asked questions. As I started to get very emotional in that moment and then started to cry, he gave me the space to do that. He put his hands on my shoulders to let me know that he was there, but he never tried to make me feel better. He never gave answers to any of my questions. He simply asked me more questions. And then after about 15 minutes of that, and after I had kind of started to gather myself back together, he looked at me, and this was a turning point for me and how I began to think about vulnerability and even what it meant to be a man. He said, you know, Nate, we've known each other for a couple of years now. This is the closest that I've ever felt to you. And that was a pretty important thing for him to say. Not only, you know, was he communicating that it was okay for me to share this, but it was more than an okay. It strengthened the relationship between us, and it brought something there that hadn't been there, a certain level of intimacy, a connection. And to this day, we remain really, really close friends. And so for me, that just taught me something about what it meant to be a man and what it meant to be in relationship with other men and with other people. So that was a pretty profound experience.
Now, I'm guessing we have guys listening right now, Nate, that they're their hackles are going up and going, I could never do that. Especially if they, let's say, grew up in a Dutch Reformed home or a Scandinavian home where, you know, their dad was very stoic and there was never emotion expressed. And they're thinking, I could never do that. And there's no way. And yet, let's just talk about how Jesus did it. Let's talk about what happened at the Last Supper. Let's talk about some of those relationships, those times we see him in relationship with his disciples and certainly with his heavenly Father, where he was vulnerable. What a great model that is for us.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, the vulnerability that Jesus displays for us in the Garden of Gethsemane, where he is in just such anguish over what is about to take place and the authenticity that he has in his relationship with the Father, is just beautiful. And there's something there for us to learn. Do we feel that much? And are we willing to express it if we do? That's just wonderful. I think the other thing that really stands out to me as you were talking about that is being vulnerable means that we do open ourselves up to being hurt. And again, we see this in the life of Jesus, right? We see this as Jesus has to say to his disciples, get behind me, Satan, right? Like they kind of get into a space a little bit. Or even the fact that Jesus washes Judas's feet.
Mm-hmm.
He is vulnerable. He places himself in that, he opens himself in that relationship, and yet Judas betrays him. And I think that for me as a guy, that is such a powerful image. What does it look like for me to open myself, to be fully who I am, even if the other person might hurt me? Because I think that in some ways, as human beings, when we love, when we enter into relationships with other people, we have to be willing to risk getting hurt. And that's exactly what we see in the life of Jesus.
And man, that's scary, Nate, even just as you talk about it. And it reminds me of the importance of finding safe people in our lives. You know, Henry Cloud and John Townsend, a couple of Christian psychologists that I know, wrote this wonderful book a few years ago. It's probably been out 10 years now. It's called Safe People. And the whole premise of that book is, how do we find individuals in our lives who are good for us, who will build us up, who will encourage us, who will let us be vulnerable and transparent? And how do we avoid those individuals who may be unsafe and destructive and dangerous in our lives? And what they've done is they really kind of start off with God's view of character and how the fall has impacted us and impacted our, you know, our true nature. And then they kind of guide you through this list of personal and interpersonal characteristics of the safe person and the unsafe person. And here's what I love best about the book, Nate, and I think you'll appreciate this too. So you're reading along the book, you're now like three quarters of the way through it, and you're starting to evaluate all the people in your life. Oh, he's unsafe. Oh, she's unsafe. Oh boy, my mother-in-law, man, she's not safe. And then all of a sudden the next chapter is, okay, let's kind of turn the microscope around and let's look at ways that you are unsafe. Because all of us are fallen and all of us have weaknesses. And then it sort of asks you some of those really hard questions, and you need to say, oh boy, here I have been. I guess I should get the log out of my eye. And then I think one of the neatest things they do in the book towards the very end is they talk about a safe church. They say, here are the characteristics of a safe church, and here are the characteristics of an unsafe church. And if you go to a church and you're hearing things like this from the pastor or the leadership, turn and run. And here's why, because these statements or these policies or these beliefs are not biblical. And so I'd highly recommend that book, along with your book, Man Enough, How Jesus Defines Manhood, for guys and for ladies. If this is something that you've had difficulty finding those safe, trusting relationships in your life, maybe that's one book to read. Hey, Nate, we're going to take a quick break, but I want to offer our listeners, I have three copies of Nate's book to give away. And guys, if this is something that has resonated with you or maybe scared the socks off you, give us a call right now at 877-93-FAITH. We'll put you into a drawing for a copy of Man Enough, How Jesus Redefines Manhood. 877-93-FAITH. And again, at the end of the hour, we will have this drawing for three copies of this book by Nate Pyle. Take a quick break and be right back with a final segment here on the Faith Radio Network.
back to Dr. Bill Meyer live on Faith Radio.
Hey, welcome back. During the break, you might have heard us talk about Project Angel Tree. If you'd like to get involved in Angel Tree, just go to myfaithradio.com and look for the little Angel Tree logo and find out more. That'd be a great opportunity for you to make a huge difference in the life of a child whose parent is incarcerated. In some cases, both parents incarcerated. It is just a wonderful program. I was involved in it with my church where we went out and visited children who had moms or dads in jail. And so check that out, the Angel Tree Ministry at myfaithradio.com. Well, my guest is Nate Pyle. He is the author of Man Enough, How Jesus Redefines Manhood. This book is partly Nate's own personal journey, but as a pastor, Nate is a lead pastor of Christ Community Church in Fishers, Indiana, which is a suburb of Indianapolis. As a pastor, Nate is trying to set an example for the guys in his church on what it means to be an authentic man, a man after God's own heart, that is willing to, yes, be strong at times and, yes, be courageous. But sometimes being courageous means being vulnerable and being honest about our failings and our struggles. And Nate has learned to do that. I'm curious, Nate, can women and wives benefit from the message of this book?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a couple of different ways that women and wives can benefit from the book. One would be simply by understanding some of the pressures that are placed on men to sort of man up, or to, you know, to portray the image of a certain kind of man. I think that women would gain an understanding there. But my central thesis of the whole book is kind of a double play on the words man enough. That the reason we can say that we as men are enough is because that we have been adopted by God through Christ and his work on the cross. And that when God looks at us, he says, you know, because of Christ, he says, you are enough. You don't have to prove anything. You don't have to prove yourself as a man. You don't have to prove yourself as an individual. You don't have to prove yourself good enough. The cross says you are enough. You are accepted. You are deemed worthy. And that message, whether it's for guys or for women, is one that we all need to hear, that we, because of Christ, are enough, that we are worthy. There's nothing we have to do to prove ourselves anymore. God has adopted us in Christ as sons and as daughters. And I think that's a message everyone can benefit from.
And you know, something that this time of year, Nate, that message is so important, because we all know people in our lives who do not know Jesus Christ as their personal Savior. And, you know, maybe even this week, God will provide opportunities for you to have a conversation like that with somebody, maybe with a guy who's really hurting, maybe with a guy from your workplace who's struggling with his marriage or is going through a health crisis or has a pornography addiction, or, you know, it could be a wide variety of things. And for you to be able to say, you know what, Jesus Christ offers you complete forgiveness and grace, and you don't have to earn your salvation. You don't have to be good enough to come to him. In fact, just the opposite. He accepts you just the way you are in all of your brokenness and your sin. And man, if that's not a hopeful message this time of year, I don't know what is. So, Nate, this is really an important message, I think, for us as dads to pass along to our sons. And I'll be honest, I have a 12-year-old son. I have a boy and two girls. My son is the oldest, and he has been picking up some messages from his middle school that I'm not particularly excited about. And there's a real emphasis there on guys kind of, you know, the seventh grade boys being smart Alex and being the tough man on campus. And, you know, he played on the football team this past fall, and it's, you know, it's all about, you know, macho-ness and all. And I've been struggling with that a little bit. And I know you have a son. I think he's a young son as well. How are you planning to, or how are you currently helping to sort of steer your son in the right direction when maybe the culture and maybe even his peers or his classmates are giving him a different message?
Yeah. So my son is 5, and as I was writing this book, I kept thinking, what do I want him to know about what it means to be a man? What do I want to say to him when he's 12, 13, 14, 15, all the way up to 25, you know, what do I want him to know? And here's what I've been reflecting on and what I see. In our culture, men constantly have to prove themselves. You talk about your son being on the football team in middle school. I think that what happens at that age and even later is as we transition into manhood, we constantly feel the pressure to prove ourselves. I am enough. I am a man. Look at all these things that I can do. Look how hard I hit. Look at how much I'm willing to stand up to authority, you know, how much of a smart aleck I can be. Or even when we talk about, you know, sort of the whole, you know, look at how I am with women and all the conquests that I have there or whatever, you know, that we constantly feel the need to prove ourselves. I think that starts in middle school. I think it goes all the way up, and some guys never get out of that rat race of trying to prove themselves. In the book, I talk about it as men, we are taught to celebrate, climb, and conquer, right? So we celebrate our victories, we climb the corporate ladder, we conquer our foes. That's what men are told to do. And what I really want, what I see in Christ is the complete opposite, where he denies himself, he descends even unto death and dies to himself. So deny, descend, and die. And so what I'm trying to teach my son is, as he now comes home and he cries because he had a really hard day or somebody wasn't nice to him, I want to teach him that his emotions are okay. So I let him cry. I don't tell him to buck it up. I don't tell him to, you know, like, it's not a big deal or whatever. I ask him, why does this hurt? How do you want to respond differently? How did this make you feel? Do you know of any other kids in your classroom who might be feeling what you're feeling? I'm truly trying to teach him how to embrace his emotions. And as he continues to get older, the message that I want to give him is I dedicated the book to him. And I said this right at the beginning to my son. I said, you have nothing to prove. I want him to know that he has nothing to prove when it comes to my love for him. I want him to know that there's nothing for him to prove when it comes to Christ's love for him. And to continue to teach that and to reiterate that through my interactions with him as he is in school, as he starts to play sports, as in all these different arenas in his life, you don't have to prove anything. You are loved. You are beloved. You are accepted as you are, all the while teaching him and modeling for him what it means to be fully human as Christ is fully human.
Wow. That is a beautiful message, Nate. That's very inspiring to me, and I'm sure to many dads who are listening today. And my prayers go with you as you try to help your son. Obviously, at five, he hasn't really even experienced some of the junk that our culture is going to be throwing at him. And I'm trying my best with my 12-year-old, and yet I have to admit, sometimes I feel like a salmon swimming upstream because the culture and the media, and we don't watch a lot of television in our house for that very reason. But one of the things he does love to watch is NFL games and college games on TV. And you know what you're seeing in those commercials. Oftentimes, you know, it's a very skewed view of masculinity, or you know, even worse, it's the dumb guy, the nerd guy that, you know, they're contrasting sometimes as a joke. You know, they have the stupid guy in the commercial where the woman is strong and the guy is a complete goof. And those messages just, you know, they're pummeling our kids. And now through mobile technology, they're pummeling them 24 hours a day. So we have, I mean, we really need God's help, I think, to help to, first of all, maybe inoculate our kids from some of these cultural messages, and then to steer them in the right way, in the way of Christ, in that way that you've talked about, which is so countercultural. So, well, Nate, some great material in this book. We've just got about a minute left. If you would, just give a challenge to the guys who are listening today. Maybe some of this stuff is foreign to them. Maybe just give a quick word to them, if you would.
Yeah, I would just challenge guys to be courageous in being vulnerable about all that they're dealing with, the good stuff and the hard stuff, that, you know, the stuff that they're proud of and the stuff that they're ashamed of. Just be courageous. We're so often taught courage is running into the burning building, but sometimes courage looks like saying what's so for you, being who God created you to be. So I would encourage all the guys out there, be courageous today with those around you in your relationships.
Oh, thanks. Nate Pyle, the author of Man Enough, How Jesus Redefines Manhood, here on the Faith Radio Network. Thanks, Nate. Have a wonderful weekend. Merry Christmas.
Thanks, and Merry Christmas to you all.
This is the Faith Radio Network. Thank you for joining us today. I'm Bill Meyer, and blessings to you and yours as we approach the celebration of the birth of our Savior, Jesus Christ.